Highbridge Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Arroyo by Chip Jacobs. Read by Joel Richards. Far better it is to dare mighty things, to win glorious triumphs, even though checkered by failure, than to take rank with those poor spirits who neither enjoy much nor suffer much, because they live in the great twilight that knows neither victory nor defeat. Theodore Roosevelt. Prologue. Mr. Incidental.
Narrowed it down, haven't you, buckaroos? You see a wheezing old man in a tuxedo and top hat, acetylene torch in hand, and the choices seem obvious. I'm either a dapper escapee from a mental asylum, or a geriatric thespian shooting the album cover for an avant-garde band. Either way, you peg me as a pathetic dinosaur out for attention in this well-accomplished town. You're all wet, but I forgive you. Wrinkles can deceive. My story, or rather her story, is a razzle-dazzle whodunit from the cusp of the tailpipe age. If my knees weren't so arthritic, I'd be down on them in gratitude, thanking the cosmic breadcrumbs for shepherding me here. Now I can croak full of life, a disruptor with an AARP card. But I digress. Having been away so long, I'm proud to report our lady remains as enthralling as ever. Lithely posed, majestic from her studded crown to her floating toes. Forget age. She's as mysterious as a fog bank, epitomizing classic beauty despite the predictable skid marks. What, you think I'm laying it on too thick? That my Sears brand hearing aid runs on New Age crystals? Then inch closer for a peek. She won't bite. Just don't get too comfortable, for the old gal on this her 80th birthday has depleted her tolerance for the bullshit myths garlanded around her. Whitewashed glories, forgotten heroes. She can no longer bite her tongue, assuming there's one in there. Ever since that young man's visit, my descent into miserable decrepitude has reversed into the determination to rise above self-pity. Put pep in my hobble. Why? I now appreciate that unseen forces drafted me. Me, the crotchety fossil that detests Bingo, Seinfeld, and sports visors giving headwear a bad name, to connect the firefly dots around our silvery empress. Who killed the brightest lights this side of Busch Gardens, when Pasadena was a wonderland of possibility? Permitted our thirst for pretty objects to callous us? Let me tell you, neither an illustrious reputation nor a knack for pageantry is a force field against sin. Appearances. It's always about appearances in this damn place. No one wants to confront this bugaboo. That history, as one skeptic laid bare, is a pack of lies about events that never happened, told by people who weren't there. Well, I was an eyewitness, back when Orange Grove Boulevard was a macadam thoroughfare for our resident tycoons, and tamale cart vendors made killings on blue-collar paydays. First things first, you'll notice our lady in question has had some work done. Blessedly, the patrons who finance the procedures refuse to allow a gauche Botox job to wind back the clock, knowing a trout pout on her would constitute criminal disfigurement. Imagine Lauren Bacall, or, for you whippersnappers, Michelle Pfeiffer, with a weeping goiter. Consequently, she hasn't been so much refreshed as restored, jowls tightened, calves bolstered, along with more intimate intrusions best detailed once the children are asleep. Let me also stipulate that none of these nips and tucks were required to warrant her spot on the pedestal of all-time greats. Her unflagging grace, revealed when party animal Woodrow Wilson ran America, and you could only find one decent brand of mayonnaise, earned her stature long ago. If a person can adore someone of her physical grandeur, no offense, Sally, my beloved, color me enchanted. Allow me to confide a few darker twists. For every blandishment lavished on her, for every popping flashbulb and cream puff story, she rarely enjoyed a red carpet existence. By her mid-twenties, in fact, some of those who exalted her as magnificent and hypnotizing clamored for her summary obliteration. They woofed that she was obsolete, a statuesque has-been replaceable by the next hot number. She'd done her duty. Now take a dirt nap. You think she brooded at the conspiracies to topple her by metal teeth, no less? Never. She stood proud, shoulders back, that proverbial good sport willing to let painters brushstroke her and middlemen over-commercialize her while selling Chryslers on television. She even refused to slap defamation suits against the rumor-mongers who smeared her as a Pied Piper for ghosts and a stoic murderer of the helpless. Brace yourselves, folks. It was her human masters who superimposed that alter ego on her. Trust me here. The Arroyo Seco's queenly bridge and I go way back. Judging by the hippopotamus camped on my chest, I don't have much time to convince you either. Bribing a cab driver to taxi me from my Lasagna Tuesday, lice-old nursing home to the hardware store, and then here, almost did me in. With heart disease, high cholesterol, gout, anemia, and more, my blood chemistry is a biohazard. Miraculously, though, I persevered, with places to go at 0.5 miles per hour. Hunched forward on my walker, I clacked toward the scene of my future defacement, the August Rose Bowl and Cosmos Probing Jet Propulsion Laboratory to my right, asphalt subdivisions to the left. I brushed my hand up against her fluted railing and reacquaintance. Pure jazz. Not to gloat, but I accomplished this feat in the same fucking penguin suit that used to constitute my trademark getup when I owned the San Gabriel Valley's finest haberdashery. That I collapsed backward, gasping for breath upon reaching my destination, a bench inside one of the bridge's romantic sitting areas, was admittedly less dignified. Again, feel free to decry the vandalism I'm plotting against this nationally recognized landmark afforded all manner of federal protections. No, I'm hoping to win your absolution in the end. A liver-spotted firebrand in a sundowner canyon. It was in reading about the public festivities surrounding her grand reopening that I realized I had my opening. There'd be indulgent layers of decorations you could have camouflaged a Marine Expeditionary Unit behind. Personally, the trimmings harken childhood memories of the sycophantic extravaganza staged for presidential visits. The overkill floral arrangements and congratulatory banners, the ritzy, color-coordinated table settings and special refreshments. Thank you, City Fathers, nonetheless. Your bridge party is allowing me to be the asshole I need to be. Now, excuse me while I try not to die. Phew, that was a pain. Not that I was ever agile with power tools, but I have a suggestion for whoever manufactured the acetylene device I just lit to slice through a section of the iron suicide prevention fence. You might mull lightening future canisters for us elderly deviants. No such gripe with my leather side shield sunglasses, which I recently fished out of my keepsake trunk to recycle into welder's goggles. Like history, fashion is circular. Shades popular with biplane pilots and progressive age motorists are de rigueur again as steampunk aesthetic. The person at the epicenter of this gave them to me as a child, along with the surprise in my bag. My hope is that they'll persuade him to speak truth to concrete, that he'll remind Pasadena that for all its old money, probity, and cultural firepower, it's the light in our collective eyes that counts more than our rose water vanity. Last time he saw me, he called me cuckoo. So I have my work cut out for me. Another absurd truth dawns on... Oh, crap, here comes the fuzz. It's go time. He's gangly and balding, this 50-ish cop, with an aura of resigned diminishment in his drooping shoulders and scrunched-together features. Roughly 30 feet away, he's approaching from the east, visibly annoyed at his day-wrecking development. Me. "Excuse me, sir, but mind telling me what you think you're doing? That fence you just destroyed is public property." He's speaking in a loud husk, assuming my waxy face also confers deafness. "Yes, officer, I'm quite aware of that. There's no need to yell." "Good, then stop." Not to split hairs, but stop what? Cutting the fence or not revealing my thinking? My glibness is poorly received. I know this because the cop's nostrils flare and his palms stiffen in double halt formation above his night blue uniform. He must be working morning security for the rededication bash following the Queen's $27 million structural/seismic rehab. Poor sap's probably visualizing telling his captain that this geezer outflanked him. "I'll clarify," he says. "Lay down the torch. That's an order. You could hurt yourself or someone below. You wouldn't want that on your, conscience." Under his breath, he mumbles, "Jesus, of all days for a 5150. That's police code for nut job unloosed. He's confused me for a jumper. "Whatever is eating at you, there's help available." He's roughly 15 feet from the bench now, with the forecast calling for a high chance of another "life is precious" cliche. Soon he'll have the bead on me. "Officer, I can assure you I pose no threat to public safety or myself. I'm here to set some records straight, non-violently." "Aha, I knew you were educated. And I'll tell you what, since you're dressed like Alfred from Batman, I'll be your Commissioner Gordon. First thing I did when I was assigned here was drive past the mansion behind you they used as Wayne Manor. Sergeant Daniel Grubb, requesting permission to approach. And you are?" "Name's Mr. Incidental." My curveball annoys him. He scratches the tip of an ear the size of a soap dish, still plotting to charm me into surrender. "Is there someone we can contact? Someone looking for you?" Officer Sneaky has further narrowed the gulf between us. "Why, yes," I respond. "There is one particular individual you can track down. But I'll need time to explain it all first, so you don't think I'm certifiable." When I dip my head and wink rakishly to accentuate that point, my top hat tumbles onto the sidewalk in front of where I sit. Embarrassing. "Leave that where it is," I add. "Let me propose a bargain," he says slyly. "You desist from further tampering with the fence, and I'll agree to your terms. This doesn't have to escalate. Big events starting here later today. The mayor, speeches, giant scissors, the works. Fair?" Fair? Really? Fair would be sparing the Branch Davidians from burning to death in Waco, Texas, or those innocent kids from being gunned down here on Halloween night. Fair certainly isn't blaming yours truly for defending himself after a pimple-faced shoplifter punched him years earlier. "Exhausted as I am, Sergeant, I can't. If, out of principle, I have to sever a hole in this fence and drop a few things on the vulgar condo below, I will." "No, you won't. I'm going to counteroffer you, one gentleman to another.
As a retired businessman, I've seen this move. Compliment, disarm, and then blitz.
Don't test me, I say, though I bet he will. I still have my reflexes.
With a flick, I reignite my orchard supply torch in my white-gloved hand and tug down my side-shade sunglasses. The nozzle hisses a burnt orange stream of fire, which I briefly aim at him. Then I run the flame over the lower part of a half a dozen fence posts, whose upper ends I previously sliced. After a little more melting, one good whack will probably detach it, sending a roughly 3-foot by 3-foot section crashing downward. Grub's mouth plops so wide I count 3 fillings.
That's a fucked-up move, he snarls. I thought we established a dialogue.
They're not mutually exclusive. He's done reasoning with my feisty curmudgeon routine.
Dispatch, he says into the Motorola walkie-talkie clipped near his right epaulette. Sergeant Grubb requesting backup to the Colorado Street Bridge, and probably the department shrink if she's around. Copy?
Sss.
I said, you copy?
Evidently no one does. He wrenches down on his Motorola to bring it nearer to his mouth.
Dispatch, dispatch, he says louder.
Nope. Still static isolation. The Flatfoot, even so, has drawn closer. Once he bum-rushes me, he won't even require handcuffs to subdue me, just a decisive hand around my grizzled neck. For a lifer, likely a decade from his pension, Grubb has moves. And again, so do I. When he lunges at me, I release the torch, which clanks metallically on the bench. My weapon of choice is less formidable, outwardly anyway. It's my walker. The action-reaction is karate-esque. He barrels my way. I bash him in the temple with one of the walker's space-age light aluminum arms.
Kia!
Down goes the sergeant. Down in a heap in my polished Italian loafers. For the first time in years, I'm a senior in control. He comes too quickly, perpendicular to me, discovering that he's pinned down on the deck. One of my walker's green tennis ball-tipped legs presses on his throat. The other squishes his crotch. While old age has shrunken me, I'm still 6'2", so my legs fit easily over the top of the walker to keep the pressure on. From the concrete, Grubb sputters statutory threats about how I'm guilty of assaulting a law enforcement official, how I've ratcheted a minor vandalism charge into a felony, how my walker better not have fucking cracked his Ray-Bans, the location of which, like his police cap, he's unsure. He's a squirming human alligator, ashamed at his predicament, madder by the second. Anxious about what I've done, hey, even us old fogies saw the Rodney King thumping. I subpoena every stringy muscle to continue immobilizing him. I grunt. I channel applied physics I heard at a free Caltech lecture. I ask God why he's led me down this preposterous road, and to spare me physical agony once the officer 30 years my junior breaks free. That shouldn't be long. Heart palpitating, I wonder about releasing him. Pleading for mercy, blaming the antidepressants, a dead wife, despair over my evaporating social relevancy. Anything. Then, faster than the hot winds blow, to quote from those gods of classic rock, I sense a change in my combatant's degree of resistance. His writhing is slowing, so too have his hands, which before were scrabbling for leverage.
Sergeant Grubb, whom I'll soon learn transferred to Pasadena after the 1992 Los Angeles riots made him question humanity, has stopped fighting because he's worked the math.
He's calculated that he wants to hear my far-fetched yarn a few integers more than he desires to club me within legally defensible police guidelines.
"Sonny Jim," I say, "let me ask you something. Do you believe in second chances?"
He eyeballs me from his back.
"Depends on what kind," he says. "For a codger quicker than he looks?"
"No. The kind, and this will sound worrisomely eccentric, that Shirley MacLaine would applaud. Life repeats."
"Not really. I'm Catholic. We believe you go up or down, not around. But if you can spell it out before any of my colleagues see me like this, imprisoned by a glorified cane, I'm open."
"Deal. Imagine a past when..."
The Birds of Pasadena. Say what you will about his morning pep and cowlick, his galling diet and corny pride. No one ever rode Mrs. Grover Cleveland, the animal, quite like Nick Chance. Already the speediest one in the yard, she shifted into another gear whenever Nick sank down on her fluffy mane and whispered encouragement, promised a treat. Today, as she folded her black wings into her white chest to blow ahead of the competition, you might have expected smoke coiling off her hooves. They didn't call her the feather cannonball unwarranted. Nick's companions breathed her dust, but on this 4-mile pleasure dash, anything was possible. Adept a rider as their front-running chum was, they knew he often grandstanded in the lead and sometimes took harrowing spills he was fortunate to walk away from with only bruises and a laugh. So they pressed their boots into their own steeds, whooping to themselves, this wasn't over. The three good-timers raced under the trees atop their 6-foot-tall birds, whose feathers were guaranteed retail gold. Moving at a blurry clip, in a canyon being auctioned off by the day, the group rooted up dust onto a pathway trimmed with imported shrubs and plants, where gauzy light laced through the veiny branches. Everyone, human and beaked, wished the jaunt could stretch into dusk. Their valley trail was pristine, so far as trails go, and empty, with no snobs around to bewail what they couldn't comprehend. 2-legged animals being ridden saddleless, low to the ground, where hands served as reins. The steeds, cobra-necked creatures, more prehistoric roosters than horses, high-stepped in this amber light, their clawed feet parumping on the terrain. Mrs. Cleveland was particularly delighted to be away from her monotonous day job being sheared for the textile business. She cranked her pimpled mouth to telegraph this.
"Uh-oh! Uh-oh!"
The ostrich's shriek of joy carried a wild edge. The posse next burst into a shamrock green meadow, clomping past mossy ponds filled with ducks and swans, then grasslands, and then chubby sheep, too busy grazing to observe this unusual bunch. Nick, a dark-haired free spirit in a white collarless shirt, was also ready to whoop. Rotating his torso back, eyes electric, he shouted at his pursuers, "If either one of you idiots says life can get better than this, I'm stealing your wages. I swear it." The best part for him still lay around the bend, due north, though he didn't advertise what others might call obsession. Waldo Northcutt and R.G. Crum nodded in agreement, snapping mental photographs of their lunchtime joyride away from Causton, world-famous ostrich farm where they all worked. Someday they might be retelling escapades of how they mimicked cowboys, if only for a few hours a week, on the backs of quicksilver beasts native to South Africa. Reverie over, the burning competitors in them tried closing the gap, even if it was merely for show. Around them now flew hillsides blanketed in myrtle and ivy, tarweed and wild oats. Vistas of fauna and flora so pervasive they provided 30 gardeners full-time employment. Before long, they came to the perimeter of the more formal section of the grounds. This part of the Great Wash was brushed with stands of willows and redwoods, wisteria and camphor, cacti and oaks. Each were meticulously planted to shade park benches and picnic areas, or simply to conjure whimsy. A master horticulturist from Scotland, with a $2 million budget, crafted this nature preserve and semi-private park, consumed by the tiniest detail. Robert Fraser spaced the jacarandas and birds of paradise so they didn't upstage the citrus groves. He researched what type of mulch to shovel into the scented flower beds for durability. Every inch of these 30 acres was actually his boss's backyard, and America's beer king demanded nothing shy of arboreal perfection. "Make it beautiful," Adolphus Busch commanded, probably with his German-accented bravado. "Make it different, regardless of expense." His Scotsman listened. The three riders, all raised here in the foothills of the Sierra Madre mountain range, appreciated the transformation of the ravine from tin can dump and animal graveyard to botanical eye candy. Since Adolphus began wintering in Pasadena in 1904, his gardens were graded and hoed, contoured and planted into the unofficial eighth wonder of the world, all courtesy of his staggering wealth and ferocious imagination. Blindfold the trio, and they could still pinpoint the fairy tale nooks where terracotta replicas of Little Red Riding Hood, Hansel and Gretel, and other mystical beings awaited children's squeals. Fast upon them was the baby elephant statue, then to the right, the thatched roof old mill home with spinning water wheel, the latter a residence that Adolphus converted into a playhouse for a daughter. Nice childhood, if you were born into it. Even so, it was the sunken gardens, a dreamscape of grassy veld, terraced in circular patterns over banks and swales, that could spur the cruelest heart to skip. Trails to explore them dipped in rows around planters and benches, a canvas of variegated green finer than the world's priciest golf courses. Optically, it was as close to heaven as mortals were permitted. The three compadres and their amber-eyed ostriches, Nick's Mrs. Cleveland, R.G.'s Mr. Mahatma Gandhi, and Waldo's Maggie had cavorted here before. They galloped along the familiar path, just beneath the first step, batting around sarcastic jibes characteristic of 27-year-old men hesitant to fully grow up. Busch Gardens was theirs, this being mid-September, except for a few couples gripping maps sticky pink with cotton candy. R.G., freckled and fair-complected, was the first to hear the intrusion of a black motor car puttering to their right on a trail-hugging road. Being in the rear of the pack, he initially paid the gatecrasher no mind. Then, as the car persisted alongside, he recognized he must. The automobile, a shiny black Ford Model T with its top down, appeared intent on making a statement. Animals were quaint, but engines were California's new apex predator, even in a rockery chattering with birdsong. Behind the wheel was an older man in a charcoal suit, who had bushy eyebrows akin to a supercilious owl. R.G. didn't dislike him entirely, amused by watching how the driver's gray hair and shaggy mustache quivered in the wind like wild grass. A minute elapsed before R.G. noticed something alarming. Rather than a delirious grin about being in Adolphus's oasis, the man's expression was competitive. Pinkies to lips, R.G. whistled to Waldo ahead, next hollering, "We got company!" Waldo's eyes bulged after the Model T man chugged past him and toward Nick. Between the driver's puckered face and lead-foot pace, it was obvious he was egging for an impromptu race between, as it were, metal and feather. Waldo pinched Maggie's lower neck, coaxing it to slow from gallop to canter. R.G. pulled up next to him on Mr. Mahatma Gandhi. Maggie was named for a character in the comic strip Bringing Up Father. Mahatma, because the pacifists at the farm revered Gandhi, and this bird had his eyes.
"Should we attempt dissuading Nick?" asked R.G. "I fear this could culminate with a priest over someone."
Sample complete. Ready to continue?